This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hundreds of movement leaders, activists, organizers, funders, and journalists gathered in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2023 at Alight, Align, Arise, an invitation-only conference on reparations organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the media partner at the conference, Yes Media spoke with more than a dozen prominent organizers, activists, and leaders, and among them was Maurice Mitchell, the national director of the Working Families Party. Maurice is a nationally recognized social movement strategist, a leader in the movement for Black Lives, and a community organizer for racial, social, and economic justice.
I'm Maurice Mitchell. I'm national director of the Working Families Party.
So, Maurice, this historic gathering here around the issue of reparations is something that is discussing an issue that's been in movement spaces for a long time, but it seems to be closer to becoming a reality. Tell me your path, how it crosses into reparations, what your work in social movements around reparations has been.
Well, I've been organizing most of my life, and I come from a family that was politicized. And so I grew up with stories about Marcus Garvey and the Pan-African movement and the Black Liberation Movement and decolonial movements around the world, and especially people of African descent freeing themselves from colonial bonds in Africa and the Caribbean, and all of the efforts that since slavery and since the beginning of this crisis that we're facing, that includes the transatlantic slave trade, the depossession of indigenous land, apartheid, what my role is as somebody who is inheriting all that. So this is to me a life's work, me intersecting as a person of African descent, as somebody who has ancestors who braved the Middle Passage, recognizing that we can't move forward unless there are true reparations. In my work, I remember as a college student at Howard University, hearing about the work of NCOBRA and many of many of the folks who in the 80s and 90s laid the groundwork for where we are now. I remember H.R. 40 and the work of John Conyers in Congress. And now I run a independent political organization where we're electing people from the grassroots all the way to Congress. And we have the honor to be able to elect people who are taking reparations seriously as a serious demand. You know, in 2014 and 2020, those movement waves that brought millions of people out to the streets, I think shifted popular consciousness around racism and anti-Black racism specifically. So the culture has shifted because of what the movement has done. And because of what the movement has done, you have movement-aligned candidates, many of which we're endorsing. And so the conversation is more ripe than ever. This was a conversation that, has been an aspiration for generations, that is now so popular that candidates who want to assume the highest office, president, need to engage seriously this question of reparations. So to me, it's just a matter of time. I feel like we're getting closer to a tipping point moment.
So there are now hundreds of lawmakers that have put their names onto legislation saying that they support at least a commission to study reparations. But what about the new crop of, there's a lot of young progressive lawmakers of color who are bringing, as you were saying, movement politics into the halls of power. Are they embracing the idea of reparations and able to push, some of the lawmakers of earlier generations, push them further on this issue and related issues, reparations and also broader racial justice?
Well, I mean, I think a perfect example, a relatively young, new, independent, progressive voice in Congress, Jamal Bowman. Reparations is one of his main priorities, right? And he talks about the work that is done in the past, right? He is connected to the broader struggle, and he also recognizes that in this political juncture, there's an opportunity to move it forward, right? So I feel like a lot of those voices recognize the work that, has been done. Like I mentioned, like he often references the work that Congressman Conyers and others did, and is also saying that it's now time for them to, you know, people like him to take the baton, right, and establish what the next iteration of that work looks like in Congress, right? And so it's like, at a certain place, it's not just simply studying reparations. There's enough of a critical mass of people who recognize that reparations needs to happen. So it's like, how do we operationalize it? And so he's interested in having both of those conversations, which I think is very exciting. And I think he's, you know, he's an example of many, many more people. Like when you talk about the squad, right? And as well as the freshman Congress people who just came in last, last Congress, you know, so like from Greg Kassar to Summer Lee to some of these other freshman Congress people, they're aligned, right? And so what we're seeing is a critical mass of people, a pretty significant mass of progressives who are saying the time has come for us to take this very seriously. And I think that's a good thing on the political side. On the cultural and movement side, I think what we're seeing is a shift, right? I think young people think very differently than people of past generations around this question. And what we're seeing is that young people, as they get older, unlike past generations where young people across demographics, as they get older, their opinions shift, they tend to become more conservative. This cohort of young people are sticking to their guns. And so that to me is suggesting that as this cohort of young people become more consistent voters, become older, they are going to precipitate a pretty dramatic cultural shift in terms of our political norms on a number of questions, but also reparations.
We are not very many years away from becoming a majority-minority country. And I know that the work that Working Families Party does, along with other organizations to achieve the reality of like a multiracial democracy, is, you know, is central to whether the United States goes in the way of democracy, or, you know, whether whether you have the minority rule that parties like the GOP would like to see happen. Yeah. So I'm wondering how you feel about this moment, because at the same time as there are these strides that are pro small d democracy, mm-hmm. there's this fierce backlash.
Sure. Well, there's a relationship, right? You can only have backlash against a popular movement, right? And it's a dialectical struggle, right? So the way that I look at it is, if in 2020, the movement that was sparked by the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others led to the largest social movement in American history, bar none, we shouldn't be surprised that that struggle and that movement would precipitate a large backlash, right? The backlash actually is an indication that we're winning. And if you look at the broader history of the United States, change never happens in a linear fashion. And the white supremacist instincts in the United States is woven into the political DNA of the United States. And it gets activated whenever it feels most at risk. If you think, you could use the analogy of, you know, a chronic disease that is often in dormancy, right? But could be activated. And when it's activated, then you see all of these manifestations of the disease. And the disease is always there. The disease of white supremacy is a governing property of the American polity, right? But sometimes it's dormant. Like, for example, in 2008, when we elected Barack Obama, there were people, serious people, suggesting that perhaps racism would be over, right? And many of us understood, like, no. There is a governing reality inside the political DNA of the United States that will be activated by this moment. And that's true about our social movements that really brought to the fore a reckoning around racial justice, anti-Black racism, the history of colonization. And so that led to that seed of white supremacy activated. And here we are, in 2023, and we see this backlash, anti-DEI, the politics of anti-wokeism, all these things. I look at it as a natural expression of the unique political character of America in response to significant strides towards justice. And it's an indication that we're doing our job. And so I feel very encouraged long term, because the strive towards justice is not linear, but over time, we've seen the aperture of justice expand. And I think it's an inevitability as things shift that we will become more and more democracy. But as we do that, the contradictions of America become more and more true. And that creates more and more tensions and opportunities for ruptures. You know, that there is a reason why the Civil War happened, right? And so, again, it's an indication that our social movements and our organizing is working. And it's, of course, bringing up to the fore the contradictions that have always been there around the American story and the character of the American democracy that is creating, these sort of symptoms, right, which we talk about on cable news. But those are symptomatic of something much deeper. And the protagonist is us, our movements, and they are responding to our movements.
How do we counter, how do folks in the movement counter the backlash, given that there is an armed minority that's very vocal and unafraid to use their weapons, given that the media, mass media ecosystem narrows the constraints around and the debate, given that the party that is supposed to be upholding progressive ideals doesn't always live up to its ideals. Yeah. So how do you counter that backlash with some of these big obstacles in the way? It's not enough to just say eventually we'll be the majority, right?
No, it's not. It's not an inevitability, right? And look, being part of the numeric majority does not somehow automatically, magically mean that you will have power. Look at South Africa, right? When minority white capital is threatened, it doesn't go home and decide to, fair fight, we'll shake on it, right? This is a protracted struggle. It's a chess match, right? And I think it's important for those of us that are interested in justice to take a long arc approach to justice, right? I want liberation in my lifetime, but I'm a student of history, right? And I don't think that our moment is so particular that perhaps liberation is a process versus a destination. And it's our job to do what we can in that process to fight those forces that were animated hundreds and hundreds of years before any of us were born, right? And so the way that I look at it is, like, if we have a long arc approach and we all have a shared North Star towards liberation, then that sets us up to be able to respond in real time to those chess moves, right? So, for example, we win an election, they decide elections, they move the goalposts, they decide that elections are now invalid because they don't win, right? And so if we only have like a proximal view, right, like let's win that election, we'll be disappointed because our opponents are nimble, they're ruthless, they don't play by the rules. And so we need to be as expansive and build as much solidarity as commensurate with their ruthlessness, right? And we need to have a strategy that is broad and audacious and adaptive, because we know that they're adaptive. We know capital is adaptive. We know white supremacy is adaptive. And we know that their North Star is to hold on to and expand their power. and they're willing to do anything in their power to do that. And as they lose, they become more and more desperate. So again, an indication that we're on the right track and they're winning, and we're winning, is their desperation, and their desperation will look more and more violent. You talked about their violence. The political violence is a tool of their desperation. It isn't a tool of their strength, right? So what we know is that strong movements don't need to enforce their positions with violence, right? Desperate movements that are waning need to use the tools of violence in order to be able to compel people to align around their ideals. So again, we should be, take their political violence seriously, but we should also understand the fact that they're using those tactics means that they see the writing on the wall. And I do believe that we're at a, not just in the United States, but all around the world, we're at this interesting juncture where there are a number of existential and really, really big crises and problems that require big thinking. But that big thinking doesn't necessarily lead us towards justice, right? So for example, climate change, there is an eco-socialist solution. There's also an eco-fascist solution, right? And the big thinking could align with the interest of right-wing populist, because there is a rising right-wing populism, and it's coming from the same place that is leading many people to align with our movements. People recognize that the status quo, that the neoliberal order, that many of the systems that they were told would support them and keep them safe aren't working. Many working people all across the globe feel a sense of insecurity, economic insecurity, physical insecurity. And more times than I'm happy with, right-wing authoritarians are meeting them and providing solutions that make sense to them or provide meaning for them around how to address their feelings of insecurity. And the neoliberal order is not able to provide meaningful solutions, and which is why it's so important that our movements build independent political power, create independent media, right, in order to communicate directly to working people, and to, while they're forming questions and are honestly seeking meaning, we're there to humbly be able to respond to the questions, because the right wing is more than happy to have that conversation with working people and steer us in a direction of fascism and authoritarianism. The question and the challenges and the contradictions are clear to people, right? So this issue and question and contradictions around racial justice, racial disunity, living in a country where all the countries in the world are in one country, right? There is a white nationalist solution to that, right? And there is a broad multiracial democratic solution to that, right? We're wrestling and we see the same sort of landscape. We have very, very divergent solutions. And then there's the neoliberal solution, which brought us here, right? The neoliberal solution actually brought us to a place where fascism and that very dark sort of right-wing populist solution is so attractive to so many working people, right? And so we have a choice here. And I feel like reparations and the promise of reparations actually is embedded in the potential solution, right? There's a reason why so many people on the far right are so obsessed with rewriting our history and so obsessed with being able to decide who an American is, what the identity of an American is, and what the American story is. They're trying to rewrite the basic history, the basic facts, right? There's a fundamental reason why they're doing that that aligns with their power. They're not doing it simply because they want to be mean or because they want to be racist. They understand sometimes more than some folks that on our side, they understand that our politics and our political opinions and how we vote, those are downstream from culture. Those are downstream from how we understand and who gets to be the author of the American story and what the American identity is. All of those things are in contention right now. All of those things are actually, we're in a moment of great sort of transformation. All of those things, the American identity, the American story, it's clearly in contention. Reparations and the fight for reparations is staking claim on a particular trajectory and history and identity, right? And so that's one of the reasons why reparations and the battle for reparations is so important, because it is establishing what America has to be in order to be a just and democratic country, right? And it's also establishing the truth of the American story and connecting American history to American present, right, which is a very dangerous political thing for the project of the far right.
That's a great connecting, that's a great way to connect all of these issues. If you could wave a magic wand and decide that this one thing you could do to move forward the project of reparations, what would be that one thing?
Yeah, well, our movements are doing their job, right? And one of the things that our movements have done is surfaced the question, raised the contradictions. The thing that is on my mind, and I'm biased because I run a political party, right? I would spend, if I could, I love this magic wand question. I wish we could find one of those magic wands, right? But between now and 2024, I would recruit thousands of people who could run on the local level, on the state level, and on the national level that would put reparations on the top of their policy agenda. Because the movement has surfaced the contradictions and laid the question bear to all of us, which is why we're in this conversation. And we need a resolution. And one of the places, not the only place, but one of the places that contradiction could be resolved and the question could be answered is through public policy. And that's the job of people in those positions. And we have too many people in those positions that don't have the courage, don't have the context, are not accountable to movement, and are unwilling to move this along. I mean, it is, it's not a complicated issue, actually. It's actually a very simple issue. And when you think about the natural response to genocide, the natural response to serious examples of mass oppression, right? The natural response is reparations, right? And we easily, as a culture, say never again when it comes to a whole list of horrors and atrocities and genocides. But when it comes to Black folks and Indigenous folks, it's generally, let's just get over it, right? And so that doesn't track. That there's a basic violation of the core logic of never again, but in this area, and we need to write that. And so if I wave my magic wand, we would enlist a mass movement of people who saw it as part of like a broad justice agenda, reparations, right? We need to settle the score. We need to get right as a country, as a people. We need to address who we are. Like using the like analogy of a person, right? There's no way, and we know this as people, like there's no way we could get very far as adults if we don't address the traumas of the past, right? And that's true as a country. And we will continue to revisit the traumas of the past in our day-to-day lives as people if we don't actually address them, if we don't look them in the eye, if we don't actually work through it, and if we don't actually atone for things that we have done, right? And that's true as a country.
So reparations can be mass therapy?
In a sense, yes. If we want to move forward, if we want to actually have multiracial democracy, if we want to have nice things, like if we want to have Medicare for all, if we want to have nice things, if we want to be able to do really big things in this country, one of the reasons why we can't do big things is we continue to have this albatross of the history and legacy of the transatlantic slave trade and of colonization and of indigenous genocide around our neck, but we refuse to acknowledge it. And it creates so much disunity that when there's a clear need for us to all come together to do really big things that will make all of us safe, we refuse to do it. It is a, you know, to use the, again, to like use the personal analogy, it is like a national psychosis, right? That we need to heal from. Reparations is the key to that. So reparations is not just for Black folks, although it is reparations for people of African descent, absolutely. It is the medicine to heal us of our national psychosis so that we can do all the things that will allow all people to be able to thrive and have the bounty of this country, right? The wealthiest country in the history of countries. We can't access that because we refuse to address the deep governing traumas.
Give out a website for Working Families Party.
Sure. So we're at workingfamilies.org. Also, by text, you could text Working Families by just texting WFP to 30403.
Thank you so much, Maurice.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Maurice Mitchell, National Director of the Working Families Party, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.